Mark, 38 years at Collart, and then something that was before Collart as well. So that's quite an achievement in anybody's book to be with the one organization during that time. So we have decided to produce a podcast that will talk and showcase your career journey with Collart, and also along the way, tell us a few of your wonderful and amazing stories that you've experienced in your role in an international sphere. So I guess to start with, Mark, tell me or tell us about how it all started. When and how?
Right.
Yes.
I joined Windsor & Newton on the 8th of May 1985. So people listening, and a lot of them are going to think I wasn't even born then. So it's sort of a lifetime ago. Slightly ironically, I was interviewed by a guy called Paul Woodward, who most people
Oh, yes.
remember from Kidderminster time, and he offered me the job and I turned it down.
Oh, wow. You rejected us at
I
the beginning.
rejected it because I had what I thought was a better offer. So I went to work for a company for sort of basically a month and realized this wasn't a good decision. So, and I saw the effort was still there. So with my tail between my legs, I rang up Paul and said, actually, can we have another talk? And we had a chat and I explained why. And 38 years later, I'm still here. So it's an interesting start to my career. But at that time, you also had to go and see Sister Milligan.
Sister Milligan.
Sister Milligan
Okay,
was
tell
the
us
nurse,
about.
and you had to do your, pass your physical. And the only problem was you had to do an eyesight test. And I never realized until then that I was colorblind.
Oh, really?
So,
And that's news to me right now.
which is in our industry possibly not a big benefit.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, so I was sort of red green color blind. So it has on occasions been interesting when people have started to talk about certain colors and I've sort of had a blank look that, because I obviously see them slightly different to other people. But it really was a different time.
Yes.
You had to wear a suit and tie,
Mm-hmm.
Which was always fine in England, but then when you went on a business trip to Africa and it was still expected that you had a suit and tie and sort of 35, 40 degrees worth of heat.
A little
Because
bit hot around the collar,
a
so to
little bit
speak.
hot around the collar, but you were Mr. Windsor & Newton at that time, so you
Yes.
had to sort of be seen as the person there representing the company. But I'm pleased to say in more recent times you sort of dress slightly more casually, and it's been a lot
Of
more
course.
pleasant from that time.
How has Windsor & Newton as a business then, obviously you've been representing the brand for about 38 years, how has it changed as a business, or what have you seen throughout the decades, I guess?
It's developed. We've certainly moved into other areas. And but I think the core has stayed the same. The history is really one of the history and the quality. I'd say they're the two pillars, the foundation points of the brand that hasn't changed. It's still all about quality. We've still got the reputation as being one of the best fine art manufacturers, and also being seen. We've travelled around the world. People trust Windsor & Newton, which can't be said about a lot of brands. So there's that history, there's that reliability, there's that quality, and I think we've always been fair with people, and people love fairness and they trust you.
Yes.
So that's a very, very important thing that we're seeing that we should continue to do going forward.
And amazing to get that insight that is so, as you said, so solid and the foundation for who we are. I know you have lots of stories to tell in this podcast, Mark, and I'm sure you'll intertwine them with your career journey as well. So I'm inclined at this point to let you just talk for a little while and maybe tell us about your journey. I mean, your current role, you work very much in the international markets.
Yeah.
And your role is to be away from the desk, away from a central point, and to be visiting our customers. So I wonder if you could just tell us about your career journey, maybe how it's evolved and some of the tales along the way.
Yeah, well, when I started, I ran the international shipping department.
Yes.
And then the international administration department. You had a whole team of secretaries, but at that time, communication was with customers generally via telex.
Hang on, ding-a-ling. Does anyone know what a telex machine is? We can get people furiously Google searching.
Oh, I know. It's one of those things. It's like a ticker tape sort of yes. thing that printed things out.
Mm.
And I always sort of remember it on a Saturday afternoon watching the football results, watching them come out on the screen. It was like a ticker tape.
Oh, yes.
All the scores that came out.
Mm.
And then sort of revolution happened and the fax machine appeared.
Mm.
And again, to sort of nowadays, there's very few people who use or companies that have fax machines, but they were seen as the revolution.
They were.
And it was sort of thermal imaging paper.
Yes.
Which everybody thought was brilliant until a few years later.
And it all
faded. It all faded. People had yes. all of these files of confidential documents.
Disappeared, hadn't they?
Slightly disappearing. And also, when you were travelling, you'd be away for a couple of weeks on a business trip, and telephone calls home or to the company were very few and far between. Quite often the links were very difficult.
Mm.
And also the cost. So you could be away from home for sort of a couple of weeks and maybe not speak to the office or very, very rarely speak to the family. It was sort of a 10-second phone call. You okay? Yeah, I'm okay. You yes. okay? Yeah, okay, bye. Talk to you soon. And that was it. So communication today, it makes life so much easier.
Mm.
Just if you are on a trip and you've had a tough day, you can just sort of quick WhatsApp call home just to sort of make sure everything's good with them. And also sometimes after a tough day, you need somebody to, a friendly face to talk to. As
yes.
Well.
So, yeah. So on that then, did you find the traveling lonely sometimes? Or I get the feeling that maybe you thrive in traveling, but I'm making a massive assumption here. So
I always loved traveling. I was fortunate growing up, my parents, we'd go on one summer holiday a year. So I used to go to Spain, Greece, Portugal, places like that. So I've always enjoyed traveling, and then having the opportunity to do it from a business point of view was fun. But it's not all plain sailing. You get instances. There was one many years ago, going out to Nigeria, to Lagos, and the plane landed. It was a 747 and a Lufthansa 747, so 700-800 people all turn up ready to go through customs, and Nigeria closed all of the green channels. So you had basically one red channel open with 700 people in it, because all of the other customs people were walking up and down the line saying, would you like to go to the front of the queue? Yes, please. Okay, that's $50.
Ah, bribery along the way.
So I waited for an hour or so. My customer had been there waiting for me. No mobile phone, so
of course.
You couldn't actually tell him. So eventually he gave up. And by the time I got out, there was nobody there. So in the end, I had to get a taxi. But it was sort of midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning by that time. And then you got stopped by a police checkpoint in the middle of nowhere. So
right.
And they also wanted money.
Okay, so you travelled with lots of petty cash in your pocket. Then,
yeah, like. you found ways around. And before I joined Collar, I worked for a company who was a company dealing actually in Nigeria and had the franchise of Coca-Cola.
Oh, wow.
So
okay.
I've been out to Nigeria before and you learn, part of the big bit of the job is you learn how to deal with people.
Mm.
You adapt to situations. Nigerian people are brilliant. They love having a laugh.
Mm.
So these policemen with machine guns, you've got them to laugh.
Right.
And sort of basically making fun with them and sort of saying, if it wasn't for me, you wouldn't be drinking Coca-Cola here in Nigeria. And they're looking and we're laughing, and got back in the taxi and the taxi driver said, how much did you pay? And I said, I didn't pay him anything.
Oh,
so
really?
Actually, that was one occasion. But, you know, you just judge the situation and make people laugh. And it's actually on the same trip. And it was my first trip for Collart. I bought a brand new suit. I thought, I'm going to visit customers in Nigeria, Kenya, South Africa. I'm going to look really smart.
Yes.
On the flight to Kenya, I landed and no suitcase. So sort of 3 days into the trip, nothing at all. And Ethiopian Airways gave me about £1 to buy everything I needed. So
not quite like the travel we have today, yes?
No. So I spent the whole of the rest of the trip. My suitcase went to Ethiopia, it went to Namibia. It actually did a longer trip than I did. And it wasn't actually until I got back to Gatwick Airport that my suitcase was there. And I actually picked it up and I thought, there's nothing in there. I opened it up. And the only thing that was there was the two wooden statues that the Nigerian person gave me.
Oh, my goodness.
Even my underpants and socks went.
Oh, gosh.
But they left the two Nigerian statues in there. That was the only thing that was left. But you learn to adapt to these things.
Yes.
Things happen when you travel. You can get angry and annoyed, but you just... It happens. It's not the end of the world. And you just... you get by.
Amazing. It seems like you've been to every corner of the globe from what you're saying, and I'm sure there's places that you still want to visit, but it seems like you've been to lots of different places, especially around Southeast Asia and Middle East by the sounds of it. Is there a favourite spot for you?
I think South Africa is a beautiful country to go to on holiday.
Mm-hmm.
The people, the scenery, the history is fabulous, the wine's nice. Other countries like Indonesia, there's certain parts of Indonesia that a lot of people have never really heard of. There's a town called Yogyakarta, and there's some beautiful Hindu temples, volcanoes, it's just superb places, but you know, not particularly on the tourists' route. And just going to some of these countries and then being able to go back with my wife and have a holiday there to some of those places. Really fabulous. India's fascinating. India really isn't an assault on the senses, but once you get over that, the people are fabulous. Things don't work properly, but you just go with the flow.
Right, that's interesting.
You learn so much about yourself when you travel and you put yourself in different situations. And it makes it really interesting. I had the opportunity with Steph Nebbia to go out, and she was great. We changed our distributor and we wanted to travel around to a few places and do training sessions for retailers, for artists, to get some ambassadors, get some influencers. So Steph came with me, and on one of the visits we were in Pune. And Steph's just about to start her presentation, and they presented her with a turban.
Right.
And myself. So we had to wear these turbans, and there's Steph there.
In respect for the gift that was given to you. Yes.
And Steph's looking at me thinking, do I have to wear this turban while I'm doing the presentation? But we sort of said, no, you're okay. But we all had the photos done. And people are just so kind when you travel, and you realise... how nice it is. And actually, even with that, last year I went to India with Andy Glynos, and we visited one retailer who had never been visited. It was quite a new shop.
Wow, okay.
And there's his whole family there. We got presented by a boat with a bouquet of flowers each.
Wow.
And they were just so pleased that we'd taken the trouble to go to see them, to talk to them, to listen to what they wanted. And Andy just looked at me and said, do you always get bunches of flowers when you visit retailers? slightly unusual. But it's just the joy in people's face and the thing it does for the brand. You know, those people will repeat that story over and over again. And it's even when you go into any retail shop, just talking to the staff, telling them, have they got any questions, any problems, they will remember that. So yes. When somebody comes in to buy a product, the more they know about our products, that's what they'll talk about. And they met the person from Winsor & Newton or Liquitex.
Yes.
Or yeah. L&B or Conte.
And so I'm getting that real sense from what you've spoken about that that these when you're going in store to visit these shops, that the owners and their families or the people that work for them are really imparting a little bit of their local culture on you as their welcome. And curiously, I'm keen to know that as we become a global community and things become more generic, have you seen that change over the years, or is it still very much that sense of almost like taking a step back in time, I guess, is how I'm picturing it from the story that you told?
It is changing. Mm. Because you know, Winsor & Newton in the past, we were one of the few companies who we did travel around the world.
Mm.
We did visit retailers. So you would go to a market, it could be somewhere like Malaysia, and you would visit there. There would be Winsor & Newton would be there, Dale Rowney would be there, maybe a Chinese brand, but that was it.
Mm.
Nowadays you go in, you can walk into one shop and you'll have 7-8 different brands.
Yes, yeah.
The internet, the world has got such a small place, people see lots of different brands. And they want to really support what their consumers are coming in asking for them.
Mm.
And because there's so much interaction with the internet, they see things in America, they see things in Japan, they see things in India, and they just want whatever they can get. So where in the past you might have had 2 or 3 brands as competition, today you can have 10, 12 brands as competition. Sometimes it might be that with our model that Collart uses in international markets, we use a distributor in each market.
Yes.
And then they will sell to a retailer.
Mm.
But some brands, a retailer will contact another brand and they will import it directly.
Right.
But then it's only possibly available in one store.
Mm, mm.
But that gives them a pricing advantage because they've only got one intermediary, not 2 intermediaries as we would have. So, lots more competition. So from a marketing and from pushing our brands and talking about our brands and using influencers, it's changed. Mm. Very, very much changed. The internet is changing business. Social media is very important. Years ago, people learned from books.
Yes, of course.
Or from what their teacher said.
Yes.
Now more of it is what they see online.
Yes. So despite, I guess, the change in how we connect with our customers, and I guess the demands that they request of us, is there a Mark Coulson formula in terms of how you build your relationships with customers?
There's certainly not one size fits all.
Okay, yes.
You deal very differently if you're in Australia with Jasco. They're very much, it's a battle with them. They want to win everything and you have to sort of fight back. There's a lot of Asia, the culture is a lot softer.
Mm.
And it takes time to build up trust. If they trust you, they'll work with you. So you have to be flexible and judge the situation from country to country.
Yes.
But so much of it is trust. And when we're looking at launching new products, you have to sort of make sure that the product's right, because the one thing you don't want to do is sell them a product that might be great for the UK or the American market, but from a pricing point of view, mm. or a market point of view, nobody's going to be able to afford it. So suddenly your distributor is full of stock that they can't sell. So you have to judge what products are right for what market. But in the end, the customers trust you.
Mm.
As long as you don't get it wrong too many times. We're not sort of infallible. We do make mistakes. But trust, relationship, is a big thing, especially in Asia.
Yes, great. Yeah, as we understand. So let's hear some of the stories, because I know that you've got a few. And I guess from what I've heard in our previous conversations ahead of this podcast is that there's some scary ones and there's some funny ones in there and there's some momentous ones in there too. Over to you, Mark. I'd love to hear those stories of your travels and time whilst you've been with us.
Yeah, I just after the war in Lebanon, I got contacted by a company and said, could we go out and see them? They'd like to become our distributor. So going out there, went to see them. And he said, where are you off to next? I said, oh, I'm going to Syria. He said, oh, get a taxi to Syria from Beirut to Damascus.
As you do.
As you do. And I thought, well, I hadn't really thought of that. He said, no, I'll arrange a guy, you'll be fine. So he had arranged it all. And the next morning, when I was due to leave, and I was with a colleague at that time, and this old Bristol car with this long bench, highly polished leather seats in the back was there, which looked beautiful until you started to wind your way through the mountains because you had no seatbelts or anything. And the two of us were just sliding from side to side, going around all these...
Hanging on for dear life by the sounds of it.
And then we came to a checkpoint, and there's lots of checkpoints, and we were going through the Bekaa Valley, and they sort of said, no, you have to wait here now. There's armaments, and they're practicing shelling, and so in the distance you could see all these puffs of... and hear these missiles going back and forth.
How did you feel at that time?
A bit nervous.
Yes.
But... the Syrian taxi driver seemed relaxed, sitting outside just having a smoke while we waited for it to clear, and eventually...
So it was normal everyday life?
Normal everyday life.
Wow.
And they said, okay, you can go on. So we drove to the Lebanese checkpoint and there was a queue of a few hundred people outside. And the taxi driver said, follow. So we
followed
him out there straight to the front of the queue. And he obviously knew the person there. So 1 minute later, both of our passports have been stamped and we're turning around, looking at the faces of all of these people. Some have been queued there like an hour or so. And whispering things under their breath that you I don't feeling think was a compliment.
A little bit more awkward than you were beforehand.
And then we drove to the Syrian checkpoint, same thing again. Got to there, left there, and the guy was so happy, and in the distance we could see Damascus in the distance, and his radiator burst and exploded, and we came to a grinding halt.
My goodness.
The problem was, our distributor kindly had paid for the taxi driver, so he'd had his money, so he didn't want to give any of his money to anybody to take us the rest of the way. So we spent an hour with him negotiating to pay as little to get us the rest
sounds
of
like the Mark Colson negotiating skills came out again.
So we got there in the end, but we missed the customer, so we said we'd go and see him later in the day. And again, he was so pleased we'd gone to visit his shop. He had all of his four sons all lined up in height as far as age.
Oh, wow.
And they were all there, and he was just so pleased. Would you like a drink? Yeah, love a drink. So 15 minutes later, his youngest son comes back with two pint pots of this yellow liquid. So we thought, okay, what's this? And we started tasting it, and it was fresh banana milkshake, which was really good until the next morning.
Oh, dear. I can imagine what the rest of the story.
Yeah, the next 2 or 3 days were not the most pleasant in my life.
And obviously memorable as well.
Memorable, but when you've got to go to the airport, we're on a flight to Saudi Arabia, and you're just having to take every opportunity to stop where it was applicable.
Yes.
And get on the flight and try and do as short meetings as possible for the next two days.
You continued on through this.
Yeah.
You
had all flights booked, you had meetings arranged, so you just had to make the best of things. So it happens, you just get on with it. But some of the more obscure places actually are some of the most interesting. I managed to go out to Iran a few times.
Okay.
And again, the people, I saw an old Winsor & Newton display from the late 1960s. I'd never seen in my life before, and some of the products going back that, going back that far in time. I made a sort of slight mistake that I arrived on a public holiday thinking it'll be fine everywhere else in the world. If you arrive on a public holiday, you'll be okay. Except in Tehran, there was no taxis on a public
Completely
holiday.
Completely closed down, was it?
So, but there was a flatbed lorry, and he obviously realised there could be a financial opportunity.
Right.
So he kindly offered to take me to the hotel. But obviously there had been a taxi operator there, and he'd seen this lorry pick me up, so he must have radioed a cab, because halfway on the journey to the centre of Tehran, this taxi pulled up alongside us, and the lorry driver and the taxi driver, for the next 20-25 minutes, had an argument as they're both driving along.
Driving and arguing. Wow, okay.
So the lorry driver got me to the hotel, I took my bag and I walked in, and I just left the two of them arguing outside the hotel when I went inside. One of our distributors picked me up in the evening and said, let's go out for a meal. And it was a holiday, and I'm not quite sure exactly what they were celebrating. But it's one where it's some form of religious holiday, I believe. But actually, the men had stripped down to their waists and had wooden handles with chains and were walking along the streets flailing themselves.
Gosh,
so
okay.
There was welts, there was blood.
Oh my goodness.
It was one of those things you sort of see, you've perhaps seen on television or reports, but actually seeing it firsthand was something very, very different.
An eye-opener for sure.
Yeah, so, but people are always so friendly when you're travelling. I was one time in Israel. It happened to be the secretary of the owner. It was her wedding. So I'd arrived and I said, oh, what are we doing tonight? Oh, we're going to a wedding tonight. I said, pardon? I don't know the person. It doesn't matter. You're invited.
You're just invited to this wedding.
You're invited to the wedding. So, yeah, you go along to the wedding and you sort of say hello to the bride, and there's 400-500 people at the wedding, and every table has a bottle of whiskey on, and the food and the dancing, and everybody made you just so welcome.
I'm sure that is probably down to you and the strong relationships that you built with your customers, rather than that happening to everybody. I'm making a massive assumption here, but I'm sure from what I've heard and understood, there's a lot of respect for you out there, and there'll be a big void when you've gone.
You certainly, I think one of the cautionary things I'd say about it to people is certainly don't be arrogant.
Yes.
And companies can be arrogant at times.
Mm-hmm.
We have to look at it from other people's points of view. Be sympathetic, but obviously we want to get the best for our company. But if it's not a win-win, it doesn't work. If Collart always wins and the customer doesn't win, that doesn't work. If the customer always wins and Collart doesn't, that doesn't work. It's got to work for both parties.
Yes.
If it works for both parties, you build up a relationship, you build up trust, and Collart will have problems. And when I've got to sit down and say, yep, there's a 7% price increase coming, well, it's not something they like to hear.
Of course.
You sit down and explain it, and hopefully they'll accept it. And there'll be other times where sometimes our customers have problems paying, and sort of say, sorry, there's a problem, I'm going to be a month late. We could sort of say, it's completely not acceptable, or on this occasion, we'll help you out. If it's a win-win, it's good for everybody.
That trust is a real theme that's come through in this conversation that we've heard with all of the stories that you've told so far, and you've just spoken and explained the win-win concept too. I was going to ask the one question about what is the one thing that you'll take away from Collart, and perhaps it is that, but I'll ask it anyway, because it could be something else.
It's just the number of great people, either within Collart, over the years, the number of characters that have been there, and it's been fun working with different people. It's been fun with our distributors, and a lot of our yes. distributors, I'm on the second, I think there's even one that might be on the third generation. But
so that is incredible.
Lots of family companies.
Pass it down yeah. through the family, and you've been there.
With the sort of the, certainly the next generation has wow. come along.
Mm.
But it is, it's down to people. It's a huge factor within this. And we're very fortunate in, certainly today, I think the way that Collart has changed in the last few years. I think that's a big stride forward.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, even when there might be some people that are cynical when we talk about the MPS score.
Yes.
But when I look back a few years ago and it was a negative MPS score at that time, the feeling in the company wasn't as good. You look today, there's a very positive MPS score. I think that reflects the way that the business is today, and I think it's a positive effect.
And it's lovely that you talk about that, and the timing is absolutely perfect. And no, this is not rehearsed in any way. Having just everyone completed the employee engagement survey right. and still seeing a very positive NPS score. And for those listening that don't understand the NPS score, it's an ENPS score, which is employee net promoter score, which is our gauge in terms of people, whether people actually want to work and would recommend Collart as a place to work. I've heard the stories of Collart being that negative NPS score, and it's hard to imagine an environment like that. Mm. And really nice that you've mentioned that,
yeah.
that's something that stands out.
And yeah. every company will go through good times and bad times.
Of course, so,
and,
yes.
And there was a period when it wasn't the most pleasant place to work.
Yes.
But we got through it. And you know that the thing is that people leading the company at that time knew it had to change and made a change. So it was good that it happened. And I think it is a far better place and a far more welcoming place. And people are not afraid to make comments. And there was a period where people were scared to make a comment because generally if it got shot down, it wasn't it wasn't handled possibly in the best way. We're in a far better position. And I think that's credit to a lot of people.
Nice. And perhaps possibly a reflection of how business was conducted even in a different time as well.
Yeah.
So maybe
very much.
Staying on that just a little bit, and in just staying on reflections as well, is there any one person at Collart that sticks out for you as someone that is special or you feel close to or you connect with or whatever that reason might be?
I think through time there have been various people. One person who was not the easiest person to work for, but was a gentleman called Chris Raitt, who was the managing director of Winters a few years back. And he actually gave me the opportunity to go and live and work in Tianjin. And it was a bit scary to take that leap, sort of 20-odd years ago, to go and live in China. It was very undeveloped at that time.
I can imagine, yes, yeah.
It was a big decision for me to do and to go and move, but he gave me the confidence that if it didn't work, then you weren't going to be left to drown. You would be looked after. And I took the chance, and it was sort of an extremely memorable moment or time in my life, sort of living out there with the family, and it was.
So tell us a little bit more about that time. When was it? What were you doing?
Year 2000, I went to.
Right.
January 2000. And it was, I went out for 3 months on my own in a little sort of cheap hotel.
Yes.
Until I could find some accommodation. And for the first month I was there, the warmest it got was minus 12.
Wow.
So it was pretty cold.
Yes.
And some of the time it was getting down to sort of minus 20 plus. So that was quite an experience. And then the family came out, that made it a lot better. And you actually got to, we went to the Great Wall one weekend.
Yes.
And then we had to queue for 15 minutes to take photographs of our own children, because so many Chinese people just got in front of us and wanted to take photos of our children.
Ah, right.
You had to queue up.
Mm.
The kids thought it was great to begin with, but...
And obviously China wasn't as international then.
No,
was
very
it,
so. Few.
Mm.
And especially as a lot of people in Beijing who went to Great Wall were from a lot of the village areas, and in a lot of cases... It sounds strange, but they hadn't actually seen many foreigners.
Right, yes. Mm,
so
amazing.
For them to sort of come and just see people. So that was a great experience. And even now, I think that the international team over the last few years are obviously the team that I've been closest to. And we've had such a close... knit team. It makes it so easy. I have tremendous respect for Jake. I think he's done a superb job. It's been great with Mathilde, with Andy, with Juan, Stefan in France, the whole team. But it Jake's open, honest. Jake and I disagree with each other.
Perfect. It's great to have the challenge.
But we both respect each other.
Yes.
And we both help each other. So there'll be things I'll have one point of view, I'll get him to think about. He'll tell me things and I'm thinking, okay, maybe you're right.
Mm.
It's hard to admit when something else is right, but you know, occasionally. But it's having that respect where you can challenge people and open, you know, be willing to voice an opinion. It might, you know, it's not going to be a popular opinion, but sometimes you have to put yourself out there and sort of say, have we considered all of the factors? So you know, people like Jake and the team have made it very easy for us, and we can all talk to each other and get on very well. So. Mm. And I think that that's an important part of Collar, that it has been easy to talk openly.
Yes.
And not be scared.
Agreed.
That you'll get slammed for saying something that's maybe not on point.
Yes.
But you're just giving an opinion.
Mm, absolutely agree. And it's really lovely that you have spent time to acknowledge and recognise that of your team and the international team. Who are a brilliant team. What about, what do you think you might tell the future Collart person, or maybe tell somebody that was thinking about joining Collart? What advice might you give them?
I'd say try and get to know as many people as possible. The one thing I always say to people is, if you've got a problem or you need a favour or you need some help with something, if you send an email, it's very easy for people to say no. Face to face, walk up to somebody's desk, talk to them, explain the situation. You'll get a far better reaction than just sitting at your desk, pinging emails out. Talk to people. And even in our business, you can send emails to customers, but ring them up at times. If there's a problem, ring them. Have a video call. Don't just send emails all the time. It's very impersonal. You've got to build relationships. If you build up relationships with people, you've got a problem, you can talk to them. If you only email people, it's quite often you're not opening as many doors and getting the answers that you want always. So I think, don't just sit at your desk, talk to people face to face.
Such an amazing and wonderful piece of advice that I couldn't agree more with in terms of the impact and the value that face to face connection. We're doing it now in this podcast. There's that face to face connection and the things that you learn that you don't expect to learn along the way.
Yeah.
26th of September, I think I'm right in saying
that. Yes, the last day in the office.
And then retirement.
Yeah, it's scary.
What does life look like after Collart, Mark?
Well, 2 months of it will be fine because I've got a daughter who lives in Malaysia, so we're going out to Malaysia for a week to spend with them.
She lives there because of your travelling influences, maybe?
She lived in China with us. She's always enjoyed the travel side of it. And husband's a lecturer at universities, and they've been in Canada for 4 years, and now they've moved to Malaysia. So
lovely. We have
two grandkids, so it's great to spend time with the grandkids. And then,
so you'll be on your comfort zone with suitcase in hand, travelling around.
And then 6 weeks in Australia, travelling around.
Right,
so looking
yes.
forward to that. And then sort of once the dust has settled, I enjoy playing golf, but with all the travelling over the years, I've never played as much golf. And I enjoy gardening. My wife keeps on telling me there's lots of things around the house that need
doing. I'm sure there's a nice long list being created.
There is. There's huge things like that. Mm-hmm. Just meeting up with friends and just relaxing. We do little bits of charity work with St. Francis Hospice near us.
Nice.
So bits like that. And
maybe from what I hear, some continued mentoring at Connacht.
If there's an interest, then some, I'm willing to sort of see what options there are. So, I'm happy to sort of stay involved. I'm a little bit involved with Collart anyway going forward because of the old, I'm a trustee of the old pension scheme.
Oh, right, yes.
So I'll sort of still be keeping tabs on how well Collart's doing.
I have no doubts about that.
So that'll be interesting. Mm. But I certainly never imagined I'd be staying here this long, but it's all credit to it. It's been fun.
It's hard to imagine that you're actually retiring because you have so much life and energy and vibrance to you that, age doesn't necessarily have to have anything to do with that, but it's you just joined the business. That's where the energy is, and it's so refreshing.
No, I still want to carry on traveling.
I'm sure
and
you
doing
do.
Things, so we'll see what happens in the future.
Yes. Any closing words? Any final story? Anything you'd like to add before we wrap up, Mark?
Yeah, it's when you saw us memorable moments in Collart. Obviously, living in China was a fabulous time. One thing I remember in sort of the early 2000s, I was working at Oasis actually with Reeves and Snazaroo and dealing with Europe. And
hang on, for those that don't know Oasis, can you quickly explain?
So Oasis is now our Collart UK warehouse.
Yes.
But at that time, Oasis made painting by numbers and scraper foils.
Mm.
And it was probably about £10 million a year. So it was quite a reasonable business, and we'd assemble them there. But we had one customer in Germany, a distributor for us called Mammut, and they said, there's a possibility we can get an art contract from a German retailer called Lidl. And Lidl had about 20 shops in the UK at that time. So we quoted for some products mainly made by Collart Tianjin, of tubes of oil colour and watercolour and acrylics and then easels and portfolios and we quoted for it. It's the first time Lidl had ever done it. And we actually managed to win the contract, which was £3.2 million.
Wow, just a snip in the ocean by the sounds of
it. It was 157 container loads.
157 containers. Yeah. Wow. That is impressive.
So it was, unfortunately, the following year, other companies became aware of the tender. So I think we got sort of about a tenth of that amount the following year.
Mm.
For that 1 year, we were the first company really to get in. And it was an interesting period of time.
Yes, fantastic.
And the other thing that I always remember fondly is I I was on holiday in America and I got a phone call from Richard Goodbank, who was one of the directors of the company, saying, we've just bought a company. I said, oh, who have we bought? Snazaroo. I said, oh, that's a good company. I knew of them.
Mm-hmm.
And he asked if I would help integrate Snazaroo into our business. So I spent quite a bit of time down with Adrian Ryan and Jane at Snazaroo in the early days. And it was fabulous just to see the business down there, and completely different to Collart, a very small company, but integrating it. And so I've always had a very strong bond with Snazaroo and with Adrian and the work that they do down there.
Oh, interesting. Yes.
It's just, and actually last 2 weeks ago, we were down in Snazaroo seeing the new factory, and it's immaculate. Adrian just has it running like clockwork.
Mm.
The paint room is just spotless.
Mm.
Everything's in its place. It's just organized so well. And it's great now seeing that after COVID, Snazaroo's starting to sort of take off again.
Yes, so, absolutely. Yes. Sort
of spent a lot of good times and difficult times at time with sort of Snazaroo, and but some great times with that.
So it sounds like it's quite close to your heart there.
Yeah,
mm.
Very, very much so. Mm. It was nice seeing them again sort of a couple of weeks ago, and we did a training session down there. So that was good fun. So yeah, lots of great memories, had a great time. And yeah, I've been very fortunate and yeah, enjoyed my time.
Mark, thank you so much for sharing your stories. I know they've been fascinating for me, and I'm hoping in this podcast we've captured it for life now, and it'll be fascinating for people past, present and future to listen to and hear your stories. But it's been fantastic to share this time with you and to capture it in a podcast, so I really appreciate the time.
Thank you very much. Nice to be enjoyable going down memory lane.